you. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next to number 94, original, the State of South Carolina versus James A. Baker III.
Yes,
tell me when to stop. How's that?
I think that's fine. Okay.
Good luck to you.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Linton, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Chief Justice, and may it please the court, South Carolina invoked the original jurisdiction of this court to protect the sovereign right to borrow money. South Carolina seeks to issue its general obligation bonds, which pledge the full faith, credit, and taxing power of the state without intrusion by the national government, because future state revenues are pledged to retire the debt represented by the bond. Power to borrow here is inextricably linked with the obligation to tax to retire that debt. 22 states have joined South Carolina as amicus, and the National Governors Association has sought to intervene as a plaintiff. Congress, by TEFRA, Section 310B, asserts the right to tax the general obligations of the state of South Carolina. Thus, Congress claims the right to tax the state revenue. It claims the right to interfere with the state of South Carolina to borrow. Congress thus asserts a right in an impermissible area and in an impermissible manner. The sanction and the registration requirement interfere with the state's right to borrow, and it operates as a tax upon the tax revenues. I'd like to point out a few findings of the master, which I believe are critical to the correct disposition. The master found that the loss of the tax exemption threatened is a penalty of such severity that the states have no choice. The master pointed out that prior to TEFRA, every state issued its bonds in bearer form, and that since the statute has been passed, no state has issued its bonds in bearer form. They have all surrendered the right to issue their instruments because of the sanction that's been imposed.
Yes, but Mr. Linton, the master also found that there was very little economic loss to the states as a result of that choice, didn't he?
The master did find that, Your Honor. And I'll turn to one other finding of the master that I think that is adverse to us, that is of interest to the court. The master said that the interest of the states in bearer bonds goes to the form and not to the substance. We accept to that finding. It's incorrect. The issue on the registration requirement and the manner in which the states issue its bonds is the right of the states to determine what conditions in their bond instruments the state feels would appeal to the marketplace. It's the same interest expressed by this court in Bland versus Free in dealing with the savings bonds of the United States. This court held that if the states could interfere with a survivability clause in that instance, it would threaten the right of the United States in its ability to borrow money. That's the same right that we're asserting here.
But is it a purely dignitary kind of interest?
No.
Do you concede, really, that there's no economic harm to the state of South Carolina that results from this, the TEFRA Section 310?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
But what then is the economic harm?
Well, first of all, the master found that in certain circumstances there would be economic harm. The master found that 76% of the bonds issued in this country are under $10 million, and that registration requirement would cause extra expense to the state. We don't measure the issue here, Your Honor, though, by the cost in the registration. It's the sanction, and we sought original jurisdiction here because the sanction threatens the right of the states in an impermissible way and in an impermissible area.
You know, a long time ago, Chief Justice Marshall, and I think it was McCulloch against Maryland, said the power to tax is the power to destroy. Then Justice Holmes came along 100 years later and said the power to tax is not the power to destroy while this court sits. And it seems to me you're making an argument that probably would have appealed a great deal to Chief Justice Marshall, but perhaps hasn't weathered too well in later opinions of the court.
Your Honor, we think it has weathered well. If I may point out one other finding of the special master, he noted the significance in the state constitutions when it comes to the issuance of state bonds pledging general obligations. And the master said the power of taxation and spending associated with that right to raise funds through debt issuance are essential to the exercise of sovereignty. Now, Your Honor, I'll turn to the New York decision because I recognize that in New York and both Massachusetts you have discarded the rhetoric of the right to power, the power to tax is the power to destroy. But what Justice Frankfurter recognized in New York was that if you have a commercial enterprise, that you may tax the state there, and we're not just going to have a label. But he also said this: there is an irreducible core of federalism, and there's certain attributes of states that partake of special relationships. He said only a state can own a state house. Only a state can raise funds by the pledge of taxation. And that's what we have here, is the authority of Congress to claim that it could tax us as a sanction. Congress says that it has the right to tax the general tax revenues.
Mr. Linton, do we look at this as a tax or as a regulation? There seems to be some disagreement on that precise point.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe the proper inquiry is the question of whether the Congress can assert as a sanction the right to tax the states. That is an impermissible assertion by Congress. And at the jurisdictional arguments, the solicitor...
Is that because it's sort of a threat based on an unconstitutional sanction, in your view, that the government can't regulate the nature of the bond issue by threatening the imposition of an unconstitutional sanction?
That is at the core of it, Your Honor. And the other aspect of it is that part of the right of the states recognized in this immunity from taxation by the national government as to debt which is backed up by its general obligation taxing power, is to tailor that instrument in a manner in which the state feels is most appropriate to market.
Well, what if we accept all of the master's findings of fact, which, as the Chief Justice suggests, indicate basically that in this particular instance it's not a terrible burden economically on the states? Now, what if we accept that? You want us to rely primarily on the old Pollock case and intergovernmental tax immunity. Is that right?
Well, we ask you to rely on the Pollock case to the extent that it is still the law of this court. But we also point to the Massachusetts case in which what the court said is that we're not going to get caught up in a question of whether immunity applies to a user fee, but the court there recognized that there's certain interest of the states not to be regulated by the national government when it comes to the taxing power. And I think the plural...
Bottom, what does it rest on textually in the Constitution, do you think?
The tax immunity doctrine, Your Honor. The tax immunity doctrine is bottomed on not only the 10th Amendment, but the nature of the compact. That there was an agreement whereby the national government and the states were to maintain sovereignty.
Can states today tax the interest income on federal government issuances of securities?
Your Honor, according to, no, the answer is no. And under the Rockford case, I think the issue that was decided by this court last June, so long as the interest on those bonds is a pledge of the United States, we would not be able to tax those revenues.
So you take the position that these, all these state and municipal bonds pledge the credit of the states or the municipalities?
The issue that we have, that we invoke jurisdiction on is a general obligation bond which pledges the full faith, credit, and taxing power of the state of South Carolina.
Mr. Linton, are you saying that any federal regulation of the state's authority to raise money by issuing bonds is unconstitutional?
A regulation that interferes with the right of the state to borrow.
But, and you're saying interfering with the right of the state to borrow, even though only tiny economic consequences may flow.
Of course, the issue is not the economic consequences. The issue, as far as the registration goes, is the invasion of the right of the state to determine the terms of the debt instrument. And that's, this court recognized in Bland versus Free as applied to the United States, was incidental to the right to borrow and not to be interfered with by the states.
Yeah, but of course the United States and the states do not operate on a totally two-way street in our system.
Your Honor, we recognize that, but what this court said in New York was that there's an irreducible core of federalism. You know, and there, Justice Frankfurter was particularly concerned with the rights of the states when you're dealing with taxation. Justice Frankfurter went on to say that there are unique characteristics of the states. And even a non-discriminatory tax would violate the state's rights if it happens to tax the states as states. That's the sanction sought to be imposed here.
But it doesn't tax the states. I mean, formally, the tax is not laid upon the states. If we had a statute that says any issuer of debt security shall pay a tax of X dollars, then we would have a tax on the state. This is a tax upon the receipt of income by an individual. So it's one step removed from a formal tax on the state. And therefore, it seems to me the only way you can get at it is to say, well, it's not formally a tax on the state, but its effect is such that. And then you get into discussions about, indeed, how severe is the effect, and it's acknowledged that it's pretty negligible.
Your Honor, you're correct in one sense that you said that it's a tax on the bond proceeds of the owner. But from the standpoint of the way this court deals with that, you have held that it is a tax on the state and it is an interference with the right of the state to borrow. That's not just going back to Pollock. Last June, when this court decided the Rockford Life case, the test that you used for a debt instrument that was guaranteed by the United States was, as far as the interest payments, you said that it would be on the United States. Now, in that case, you did not resolve the issue adverse to the United States because it was not a guarantee. It was not the issue. It was only a guarantee.
What about a sales tax, the burden of which is borne by the purchaser? Would you say that an individual who is purchasing something with the income that he has received from a state bond cannot be charged that sales tax? Because after all, the only purpose of getting the money from the state bond is to spend it, and if you tax that spending, you trace it back to the money coming from the state, you're burdening the state. Would you say that?
No, sir. And the court's rejected that argument. But the court has accepted the proposition that when you interfere with the right of the state to borrow, you interfere impermissibly with the state.
Well, why doesn't that interfere with the right to borrow? That's what I'm saying. That interferes with the right to borrow. The only reason you loan the state money is to get the interest. The only reason you want the interest is to spend it, and you're interfering with my right to spend it.
The court makes the distinction between the attenuated effect on the sales tax example or on the tax of employees versus the state's obligation to tax in the future. The state's, that affects on the bond aspect. When you're dealing with general obligations, it is the obligation of the state to tax its citizens to retire that debt. It interferes with the power of the states to borrow.
May I ask you, supposing Congress passed a statute that said all bonds in issues of over $2 or $3 million, something like that, must be registered. Would it be unconstitutional? That would impose the same burden on the state that you have here, only in a different way.
It would be unconstitutional because it invades the right of...
Insofar as it was enforced against the state, it would be unconstitutional.
Yes, sir. It would be unconstitutional because it invades the right of the state to determine the form of its instrument and to tailor it to the marketplace. But in this case, of course, it's unconstitutional as well because of the sanction that it seeks to impose that robs the states of any meaningful alternative. That's what the master found. The United States has not accepted to it.
Well, Mr. Linton, what if Congress said in their commerce power that no one who buys one of these bonds may transfer it without registration? And the practical effect of that is to also make the states have to register their bonds.
Your Honor, the Congress was not exercising its commerce power.
Well, I'm saying what if? Can Congress do that?
We think that a different test applies under the taxing power. If Congress did that under the commerce power, if it had the effect of regulating the states where there was no meaningful choice, I think we would be back to the issue that was addressed in the dissent in New York by Justice Douglas. These tax regulations have a tremendous regulatory effect, and they would rob the states of the ability to govern their own citizens.
I understood even your intervener, National Governors Association, thought Congress could do what I suggested. But you take issue with them.
I think you introduced a predicate that if it was so coercive that they had absolutely no choice.
Well, I said the practical effect of it is going to be that states are going to have to register their bonds.
Congress could do, perhaps under the Commerce Clause, without invading the sovereignty of the states, because then the states would have chosen to go into an area that is regulated under the Constitution. Interstate commerce is regulated exclusively by Congress. Under the taxing clause, that's not true, because we go back to Hamilton's words that the taxing power was not coextensive with the commerce power. I think the Solicitor General has acknowledged that this court has not passed upon that in page 25 in its brief.
Thank you, Mr. Linton. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Caden.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the National Governors Association does not think it necessary to reach the tax immunity issue which Mr. Linton argued. Rather, we submit that the question squarely presented in this case is whether Congress can enlist the state legislatures to its service in order to achieve a national goal. That principle, the principle that Congress may not so enlist the state legislature, has survived through all the twists and turns of federalism jurisprudence in this court, and has been most recently reaffirmed in the case of FERC versus Mississippi. The principle is a simple one. Whatever else Congress may do, pursuant to the delegated powers, it may not reach out into the circle of authority reserved to the states and conscript the state legislative machinery and put it to use to advance a national goal.
You will come to how this conscription has been effected?
Yes, indeed. When Congress, in this case, said to the states, you must register your bonds by December 31st, 1982, the consequence of that was that each state had to adjust the agenda of its legislative and regulatory bodies in order to accommodate its laws to this new requirement. And the record shows, for example, that in Kansas, 47 statutes had to be amended. In Illinois, the question of adjustment of their statutes to the registration requirement had to be put on a special agenda of the legislature. And then the legislature had to come back to make a further adjustment. And in New Jersey,
Under threat of the people who get having the bonds not having the tax deduction.
Yes. But
what about the 55-mile speed limit?
This was no condition that gave the states an option, as this court found in the South Dakota case, to comply or not. This statute indicates from the legislative history, through the stipulation of the parties, through the master's report, that this was a requirement that the states register their bonds.
Well, the states could fully not register the bonds. The only consequences would be tax consequences to the holders of the bonds. Just as the states could have declined to adopt a 55-mile speed limit, and the only consequence would have been their loss of highway funds.
I think the difference in the measure of coercion is significant here. In South Dakota,
we're talking about the degree of coercion. That's
right.
That's
right. And that coercion is reflected, as I indicate, in the fact that the legislative history indicates no intent to raise money and no effect of raising revenue. The combination of those two, as this court said in Carragher means it's not a tax. Further, in pursuant to that congressional finding, the party stipulated before the trial that this was a requirement. And the master so found, and the Solicitor General agrees that that's the better way to view it. Now, if viewing it as a requirement...
May I just interrupt for a second? You say degree of coercion. Wouldn't the amount of money lost in highway funds exceed in monetary value the amount, economic loss to cost of registration?
No, I think far from it. The penalty in the South Dakota case, if I remember correctly, was 5% of available highway funds. Here, the increase in cost, if the states failed to register and issued taxable bonds, would be 28 to 32% of their total borrowing cost, billions of dollars a year.
I thought the master found the economic cost of compliance was really rather trivial.
Exactly. The economic cost of compliance was trivial, but the economic effect of the sanction was enormous, and the coercive effect comes from that. But in addition to the coercive effect, you have the congressional finding and the stipulation.
You can coerce them, but not effectively. That's the principle.
Here the effect was complete.
That's a strange constitutional principle, is it? It's okay to apply the coercion, but not enough to be effective.
I don't think so. Here the coercion was completely effective. No state has issued registered bonds, non-registered bonds, since the effective date of this statute.
But, Mr. Caden, every time Congress gets into the act with one of its programs that it wants the states to help them out with, you have the same kind of a problem. The states have to crank up their machinery and do something about it.
You don't have the compulsion to pass laws. In circumstances where the state has attached a condition to a spending power, as this court has found, you have a realistic option not to participate. Here, if you accept the stipulation that this was a requirement, you also have the compulsion to pass laws. And it is the nature of that intrusion, not its weight, not the economic effects, but the nature of the requirement that that legislature in Illinois convene itself, adjust its agenda, and pass these laws that gives rise to the constitutional infirmity. That is a very different question than using the Constitution as a shield from a generally applicable regulation, such as was at issue in Garcia. There is all the world of difference between telling the state that it must pay a minimum wage to its employees, the same as General Motors must to its, and telling the state that it must get its legislature in session and create its own labor standards board modeled after the federal design to perform that regulatory function that Congress prescribed.
What about EEOC? And it defers for 90 days to state Equal Employment Commission proceedings if the state creates one. Now, that certainly provides a strong incentive for a state to create one and by legislation.
I think that provides an option in what is otherwise a generally applicable regulation. What EEOC did was said to the states that they must apply the same anti-discrimination provisions with respect to the elderly that a private individual did. Quite different than saying to the states...
But the Congress also said in the EEOC that if a state creates its own board, the federal commission will defer proceedings for 90 days.
Exactly, which is analogous to saying in the Hodel case that if the state chooses to set up a regulatory machinery for surface mining, it can play that role. Otherwise, it will be preempted and fall under the federal regulatory machinery. Again, I would suggest quite different from the command to the state to use its resources in service of the federal goal. This may be a small kind of intrusion, but in nature it goes to the heart of what troubles the states about the protection afforded their federalism. The Congress may from time to time narrow the circle of authority reserved to the states, but it is quite another matter, as Justice Blackmun recognized in the beginning of his opinion in Firk versus Mississippi, to reach into the remaining circle and enlist the state apparatus in the service of the federal cause. That goes to the heart of the power of choice, of the ability to set a political agenda that is so crucial to state autonomy. We know that state autonomy won't be eliminated in one large swoop. The court has not had to confront the case where Congress tells the state legislature to have only 50 members or meet every December, or choose its the members of its Supreme Court according to federal design. But what the Congress does with increasing frequency is achieve its regulatory goals by reaching over and having the state do it. That was the issue, for example, in EPA versus Brown, where the federal government set environmental standards, but until they retreated and the case was mooted in 1977, the device of enforcing those regulatory objectives was through the states. And that's what caused the circuit courts that considered that to find it an invasion of the 10th Amendment autonomy interest. And similarly in FERC, ultimately the court narrowly divided on whether the intrusion was too much. But there, it wasn't the legislative apparatus that was being commandeered. It was a quasi-adjudicative body just being asked to consider the federal standards, giving the option of getting out of the field of regulating those utility rates entirely. And here, many people have had the reaction, well, why are the governors and the mayors and the counties and the state legislatures bringing this particular case before this court, occupying this master for 2 or 3 years, when it seems so inconsequential? But the fact is, as I indicated, never has the court sanctioned a compulsion to the state to pass laws. And yet in this case, it's precisely what the legislatures, as this record unequivocally shows, of Kansas,
well,
New Jersey...
Well, Mr. Freed argues that the state has the choice, of course, of issuing bearer bonds and letting people pay the tax.
Well, he doesn't really argue that with any conviction. In fact, at page 39 of his brief, he concedes that looking at this as a registration requirement is really the better way to do it. He will take advantage of the conditional approach if need be, and he goes on to argue the tax immunity issue, because if it is conditional, then you have to consider the sanction. But when you look at what Congress did and what Congress said, there was no option being conveyed. The option was simply the technique. They meant to require registration. The party so stipulated, and the master so found, both on page 2 and in the first sentence of his conclusion. It's the right way to look at it, and
well,
it leaves the community issue.
Could Congress have achieved the same goal exactly by some other means
Yes, yes, indeed. Congress, if it had in mind curbing tax evasion by creating a record of ownership of municipal bonds, could have required that those bonds be sold or bought through brokers. Brokers file information returns. They know the amounts of those trades. And that kind of regulation would not have implicated the states at all. The states would have had nothing to do with it. They could have told the holders of those bonds in the secondary market that when you seek to buy or sell those bonds, go to a broker, and the broker will file an information return with the federal government. And indeed, that would have been a more effective. We're not arguing that the method adopted was ineffective, but that would have been more effective than the device of requiring registration. Because in fact, as you know, transfer agents don't file those information returns. You can negotiate a registered bond transferring beneficial ownership without going through a transfer agent. And so the registration system doesn't really work very well to curb tax compliance. But that's not the gist of our argument. Given that alternative means of protecting the tax compliance interest, which certainly the governors and the mayor share with the national government, to do it in a way that commandeered the legislative apparatus of the states was unnecessary and contrary to something that is very deeply held in the structure of federalism established under the Constitution.
Chief Justice, you think the 55-mile speed limit requirement would have been bad if the sanction for the state's failure to observe it had been high enough?
If
all highway funds eliminated, that would have done it.
No, it would have depended on a finding by a fact finder of whether it was coercive. That's the test this court established in Stewart and reaffirmed in South Dakota. Chief Justice Marshall said long ago in the McCulloch case that not only must the end of what Congress does be legitimate, but the means must be appropriate and consistent with the spirit of the Constitution. And what has happened here in this relatively insignificant little matter of registering municipal bonds is that Congress has adopted a technique that amounts for the first time to commanding the state legislature to adjust its agenda to suit the federal regulatory purpose. That gives rise to the constitutional infirmity that we assert. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Caden. We'll hear now from you, General Freed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The plaintiffs and their amici, the states, National Governors Association, raise with considerable heat and, I believe, considerable sincerity, important constitutional principles of federalism. I must confess to a certain puzzlement about how to respond to those concerns in this case. And I would like at the outset to suggest a kind of jurisprudential framework for considering those concerns. I take as my touchstone the words of Justice Frankfurter in his separate opinion in Graves against New York. There, Justice Frankfurter said, since two governments have authority within the same territory, neither, through its power to tax, can be allowed to cripple the operation of the other. The arguments on which McCulloch v. Maryland rested had their roots in actuality, but they have been distorted by sterile refinements unrelated to affairs. These doctrines have until recently been moving in the realm of what Lincoln called pernicious abstractions, the web of unreality spun from Marshall's famous dictum was brushed away by one stroke of Mr. Justice Holmes's pen. The power to tax is not the power to destroy while this court sits.
Mr. Freed, do you think that subjecting all interest income from municipal bonds to federal income tax could be said to interfere with essential state or local functions?
That is a very serious question. It's a very serious question which this court, although it has in the Gerhardt case and in the Graves case itself, removed the theoretical underpinning of the Pollock doctrine by overruling Collector against Day, it's very striking that in case after case, this court has declined to draw the general conclusion
right.
which you refer to.
Right. So how do you answer me?
Well, if I may answer you at a little bit of length. Congress has declined to press that issue. This court has declined to press that issue. And that is because what is at stake there is a matter of great sensitivity to the states. And I would think that just as this court has been circumspect in that regard, and just as Congress has been circumspect in that regard, and I think they have been circumspect in this very legislation. So if you would permit me, I would like to be circumspect in that regard and not pronounce or even venture a position of the government on something which everybody has sought to back away from and to avoid turning into a confrontation.
So you're not going to answer my question of whether there's any constitutional limit to the removal of the freedom from federal income tax of these bonds.
I suspect there very well may be a constitutional limit.
And on what would it
limit.
Rest?
I think it would rest on the 10th Amendment. I think it would rest on principles of federalism. It would not rest on the theory of the Pollock case, because the theory of the Pollock case was the theory of immunity at the source, and that theory has been specifically repudiated by this court on two occasions. So we would have to find a new basis, and I would think it would be rather imprudent of me, but if you press me, I shall proceed on that imprudent course, to try to devise extemporaneously what such a theory might be. But there's a great deal of...
Well, it's a concern because I'm not sure to what extent we have to address in this case the intergovernmental tax immunity problem. States are urging that we must address it. It is a concern.
It is a concern, but I believe that a concern of that degree of seriousness should not be addressed and need not be addressed in a case where what is at stake is, to speak frankly, utterly trivial. I think it would be a great mistake to precipitate this court, the United States government, and the Congress into a confrontation on a matter of the highest constitutional moment where so little is at stake.
You're not asking us to overrule what's left of Pollock?
No, because there's no occasion to do so, Justice Blackmun. With great respect to learned counsel from South Carolina and the Governors Association, I suggest that they seek to move us away from arguments having their roots in actuality, and it is they who urge on us instead sterile refinements unrelated to affairs. As I have indicated, the United States will make no argument today which opens the door to a taxing power large enough to cripple the operation of the states, nor which invites this court to relax its vigilance lest the power to tax become the power to destroy. But if we are going to avoid sterile abstractions, we must get a somewhat firmer grasp on the actualities, on what really is at stake here. For we are dealing in general principles about federalism and not in taboos. We're not even talking about procedural or jurisdictional requirements. And these general principles, unlike, for instance, the axioms of mathematics, which if true, are true to the last decimal place, they just give out at the margins. As was recognized in the Frye case, principles of federalism just cannot stand the pressure of extreme emergencies. I would suggest that also at the other end of the spectrum, where practical consequences are too slight, they also give out and just become indeterminate. Let's turn for a moment at what really is at stake. Congress had no hidden agenda in this case, no imperial designs on state autonomy. On the contrary, Congress was demonstrating a perhaps overnice delicacy about not using the heaviest weapons in its arsenal. Its concerns were that bearer bonds of all issuers, federal issuers, corporate and municipal issuers, have served as a kind of interest-bearing large denomination currency for tax evaders and others whose sources of wealth do not bear looking into. And they are much more attractive than cash in the mattress or gold bullion in a safe deposit box. And municipals are particularly attractive to those who are up to no good. Because once you get your cash into this safe harbor, there's no longer any legal obligation to pay tax on the interest or even to report it in some circumstances. Congress might simply have forbidden the transferring or holding of bearer bonds. Instead, they chose what they thought was a less intrusive measure for corporates and municipals, with the thought that this way, they would force these holdings out into the open, create a paper record, making them far less attractive for nefarious practices.
Well, Mr. Fried, suppose one thought, indeed, as I may, that there is a constitutional prohibition against the federal government taxing income from these municipal bonds. May the Congress just use that form of imposing a tax as a means of regulation, and we should close our eyes to the form chosen?
I would think in this circumstance, if that was your premise, you would still, I think, not have cause for worry because, as the special master found, and his findings are entirely consistent with the intentions of Congress, the special master found that this form of tax in no way burdened the ability of the states to raise revenues through borrowing, and indeed in no way affected how they borrowed, what form they borrowed, except in that wholly question-begging sense that, of course, they could no longer borrow in bearer form. But as far as their ability to enter the market, the terms on which they entered the market, whether long-term or short-term and at what interest rates, and for what purposes they borrowed, the special master found that this simply had no effect whatsoever. And that being so, I don't see why these...
You don't think the means selected should be proper? Well, is there no other way the government could have accomplished its goal?
There are other ways, certainly. But there is nothing improper about this means. The reason there is nothing improper about this means, even on your premise which you offer on a hypothetical basis, because the doctrine of intergovernmental tax immunity, whatever its present status, is not some kind of a taboo. It's a principle. And if, in actuality, the ability of the states to borrow, which such a doctrine is intended to protect, is in no way affected, then surely that has some bearing on how one considers the matter.
Mr. Fried, if I understand your argument, it would be constitutional for Congress to pass a statute that says if any state shall issue unregistered bonds, the governor of the state shall be deemed to have violated a federal criminal statute and shall be sentenced to prison for 3 years. If the sanction is a plainly unconstitutional sanction, you say it really doesn't matter because all we're requiring to do is something that's perfectly trivial.
Well,
if you accept Justice O'Connor's premise, that is. What's the difference between that case and the one I posit?
I'm taken aback by your hypothetical, I must admit. It's not one that in our hours of preparation had occurred to us. The reason that I answered Justice O'Connor as I did was that what concerns her is, after all, an important constitutional principle, intergovernmental tax immunity. And that principle is a principle, and that is why I vouched in Justice Frankfurter's words, is a practical principle which must be applied in a practical way. If nothing is at stake, and that is the case here, nothing is at stake, then it doesn't seem to me important to enter into the sterile refinement of whether...
Nothing's at stake if they comply.
Nothing's at stake if they comply.
So that in my example, you'd say you can threaten them with anything. Threaten with the governor with capital punishment.
Well, there would be a clear Eighth Amendment problem in that in that context.
No, I would defined class of persons in a very definitely defined aggravating circumstance. It happens very rarely.
Eighth Amendment case. I hadn't.
When one considers that the financial burden involved here is practically nil. In terms of the transactions cost, even for an issue as small as $1 million, which in terms of dollar volume is less than 1% of all municipals, although in terms of the number of securities issued, it's a great deal larger, the cost to the state, the increased cost to the state, is $165 a year over the life of a 20-year bond. And if you go to larger denomination borrowings, it is cheaper in registered form. When you consider the interest rate differential, I think that has been more or less abandoned, as well it might be, because interest rate differentials can be only a function of market preference. And if we abstract from the market preference of tax evaders, there is no rational basis for a market preference for bearer bonds. Registered bonds are easier to deal with, they are more secure to deal with, and in any event, only about 10 to 12% of municipals are held personally by individuals in any event. There is no rational basis.
General Fried, if that was the case, why did all the states issue their bonds in bearer form before this Section 310 was enacted?
Well, the master found that is simply custom and habit. Corporations also issued their bonds in bearer form, and being somewhat more flexible, long before TEFRA, they had moved virtually universally to registered form, and the master found, I think quite reasonably, that this is a change which the municipal market would have gone to of its own in any event, except for the slight problem of the very great facility that bearer municipals gave to people who are up to no good. Now, turning to the regulatory burden, I find that a puzzling argument. I think back to the FERC case, and the FERC case was troublesome, because there what happened is Congress was dealing with what, in terms of politics and policy, was surely a hot potato. Consumer electric rates will be calculated and how they're going to be allocated, a very difficult political question. And Congress sought to involve, if not to enlist, at least sought to involve the state regulatory mechanism there. And that was said to be all right, although not everybody on this court so believed. In this case, by contrast, what you have is a purely technical requirement. There is no political or policy hot potato being thrown to the states to somehow deal with within their own political boundaries. This is no more of a regulatory burden than if the Congress had said that all checks issued in the United States, including those issued by states, must have a certain format and be encoded in a particular way. And indeed, Congress long ago required the states to issue W-4s, W-2s, and 1099s in terms of reporting to the IRS when there was a state tax refund. These, as far as regulatory burdens, though they may have had technical difficulties from a policy and a political point of view, were simply trivial. And that is why I think we are dealing at a level of triviality which makes it dangerous for this court, dangerous, to allow itself to be drawn into what are really serious questions. The question that troubled you, Justice O'Connor, are serious questions. And I am disturbed that this court should be precipitated into a confrontation with those difficult questions where, frankly, nothing is at stake.
General Fried, does Congress require states as employers to withhold federal income tax?
It does indeed, to withhold, to remit, and to send W-2s and W-4s. Yes, it does. And presumably, depending on the structure of the state statutes, that may or may not require some kind of adjustment, including perhaps even some legislation. But this is not legislation such as we had in FERC, where what was involved was the state political machinery coming to grips with a difficult political choice. I think there's less at stake here than even the dignitary interests that troubled the court in Coyle against Smith. I think there's less at stake here than if Congress dictated the designation of a state flower. There is simply nothing of significance at stake at all. And that is why I say that these high constitutional principles simply, like electrons which escape detection, the high constitutional principles simply become indeterminate when they are deployed against this problem. If there are no further questions, I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you, General Fried. Mr. Linton, you have 1 minute remaining.
Chief Justice, the interest asserted by South Carolina is that Congress assumes the right to tax a state. And rather than being a trivial aspect of this case, that is the foremost issue before the court. The question posed by Justice Scalia about a tax on bond proceeds, according to this court in Rockford, that's a tax on the United States. In the reverse situation, it's a tax on the state here. And in response to Justice Blackmun's question about Pollock, you cannot apply the rule of New York versus United States or Massachusetts versus United States and sustain the action here. In each of those cases, the court was mindful of the proposition that you cannot tax the power to borrow. That's what this court also said in 1962 in Free versus Bland, when the state had what might seem a trivial interest to assert on the form of a savings bond. And this court said unanimously in a 7-0 opinion that that interferes with the ability of the Federal Treasury officials to determine the form of the instrument. They're charged with the responsibility for raising debt, and it would interfere with the power of the United States to borrow. That's the exact principles involved in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Linton. The case is submitted.